Thanks everybody for coming today. My name is David Polliner. I'm a professor of anesthesiology and pediatrics at University of Colorado School of Medicine, and I'm the director of transplant anesthesia at Children's Hospital, and I'm going to be moderating today's session. I want to thank the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for his continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. Throughout the past 11 seasons, the call has brought the Torah perspective on business and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. If you'll take a moment to look at the back page of your booklets, you'll see next month's Teach for Tea class, which is scheduled on Wednesday, March 2nd. It will focus on full disclosure versus buyer beware, and will be presented by Brad List and Rabbi Aaron Yehuda Schwab. Please let your friends, colleagues, and acquaintances know about this upcoming class. I'd like to call your attention to our executive learning program, which provides business people and professionals with the opportunity to bring Torah study into their day at the office. If you'd like to incorporate Torah study into your workday, please speak to Rabbi Schwab or one of the other call members about bringing inspiration and Judaism to the workplace. Also, please mark your calendars for the Kollel's 18th anniversary celebration, which will take place on Tuesday, March 15th at 6:30 at H. Denver. If you've missed past classes, you may want to listen to recordings, and you can find them on the Kollel website at denvercollel.org. And that also gives you the latest information on programming and archive classes on many topics on the website. I'd like to introduce today's presenters now. Brad Kornfeld is the managing partner of the Kornfeld Companies and a member of the board of Donor Alliance, is that correct?
Uh-huh.
And Rabbi Aaron Yehuda Schwab, the dean of the Denver Community Kollel. Oh yeah, so one of my jobs at Children's, I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist, and as the director of transplant anesthesia there, I am involved in obviously providing anesthetics for transplantation in children, and also involved in the decision on listing children for transplantation. I'm a member of the steering committee of the liver group and transplant groups at Children's Hospital.
So welcome everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Brad Kornfeld, as you know, and I am a living kidney donor. I donated a kidney to my dad back in 2004. And prior to that, in 1993, my dad underwent one of the world's first successful double lung transplants off of a ventilator. So our family has lived organ donation on both sides, if you will, as recipients on a list waiting for that call in the middle of the night, which fortunately for him came. And then he needed a kidney from me about 10 years later because the anti-rejection drugs that were used back in the 90s and kind of into the early 2000s unfortunately had their own detrimental effects, one of which is they essentially destroyed his kidney, and he needed a kidney from me, and I was very honored to donate. I since then have gotten very involved in spending a lot of my time advocating for organ and tissue donation. I'm the board chair of Donor Alliance, which is the federally chartered organization that is responsible for the donor registry for Colorado and Wyoming. We also do all of the organ recoveries and tissue recoveries in our region. It's one of 58 around the country. That is this crazy patchwork of organizations, but we're highly regulated. When we recover an organ, we also put that information into the National Donor Registry, and we make the offers for those organs to the various transplant programs according to the federal rules. I'm also lucky enough to serve on a national committee of UNOS, United Network for Organ Sharing, which is primarily comprised of medical professionals, either transplant program administrators, transplant surgeons, but to their credit, they do ask for lay people like me, who've actually gone through it, to serve on these boards, and we are set up by Congress to establish national transplant policy across the country. And just to give you an idea of kind of the magnitude of the issue, I checked on the UNOS website this morning, and there were 121,514 people in the United States waiting for a transplant as of 6 a.m. this morning. 12 hours later, that number has gone down by two. What I can't tell you is that because in the last 6 hours there were two transplants, or that two people passed away waiting for a transplant, or a combination thereof. But that's how fluid the wait list is. It is changing moment by moment and hour by hour. Donor Alliance, to give you a little bit of a narrower idea as to what's happening here in Colorado and Wyoming, kind of our two-state region. Well, let me back up. In 2015, nationally, there were over 30,000 transplants across the country, which was a record year. And that's a combination of living donors like myself and deceased donors as well. Here in Colorado, we had 428 people who were transplanted in 2015, and we had 134 organ donors. I think it was our third best year ever, and we had over 1,600 tissue donors in 2015. The challenge in terms of meeting this need, the 121,000 people that I was talking about, is living donation is either flat or actually on the decline. And organizations like UNOS are trying to figure out why. Some people feel that it was kind of tied to the economy, because obviously you have to take time off from work. You can't get compensated. That's against federal law, to get compensated for donating an organ. Is it because of mishaps? Sometimes, you know, it is not a perfect science. And when something doesn't go well, it gets a lot of publicity, and it might scare people off from moving forward with donation? Or are there other factors that we just aren't aware of? But what we're trying to figure out is how to get those numbers back up in a combination of living donation, advancements in science, and increasing the donor registry so that we can meet the need and get everybody transplanted and get that wait time down to zero. It's sort of a misconception that anyone who dies can become an organ or tissue donor. It really does require a very sort of narrow set of circumstances, typically a brain death, if you're going to be a deceased donor, to be eligible to donate organs or tissue. So that's why when you sort of say, okay, there were 134 organ donors in Colorado and Wyoming in all of 2015, it doesn't sound like a lot of people, and quite frankly, it's not. We do have a few cases every year where either coroners or other people don't allow donation to move forward, even against the wish of the donor. They've made their intentions clear. They've signed the registry. They've told their family, but for some reason, someone objects other than medical reasons. In terms of living donation, you really go through a pretty rigorous process and evaluation to become a living organ donor, and you can either designate who you want to donate to. So, for example, I said I'm willing to donate my kidney to my father if I'm a match. You can do altruistic donation, which is where you say I am willing to donate a kidney or a portion of my liver to a stranger and let the transplant program figure out who is the best candidate for that donation. And now there's something called these paired donations, which is really amazing to see, where in many cases up to about 10 donors and recipients get together. And for example, if I wanted to donate to my father, but we weren't a match in terms of blood type or tissue type or other factors, I could say, here we are. Are there other people even around the country who are in the same situation, and person B, their donor may be a perfect match for my dad, and I may be a perfect match for them. And now all of a sudden, instead of nothing happening, you have two transplants happening and two lives saved. These chains, if you will, are growing, And there's a lot of talk about sort of how far can you go before you risk the chain breaking down and then nothing happens. So there's a lot of that that's kind of in the works in terms of figuring out the best way to meet the need without having the whole thing kind of fall apart. In terms of our registry here in Colorado, there are several different ways that people can sign up. You can sign up, as you probably have all noticed, when you go renew your driver's license. You're typically asked if you want to be an organ donor. You can sign up that way. You can sign up on our website. And you can also do it through various other documents. But the one word of caution that I always say is no matter how you sign up to be an organ donor, in my view, it's not enough. You need to also tell your family and tell your friends of your wishes if that's something that you want to do. It's not for everybody, but if that's something that you want to do, so that your family is really aware of what your wishes are, yes or no, and can carry that out if you're in the unfortunate circumstance that that they need to make that decision. But in terms of living donation, there's so many ethical and policy issues that come up. It's really fascinating. And just to kind of tell you where it's headed before I turn it over to the rabbi, you know, now we're talking about hand and face transplants and sort of the science behind, the ethics behind that. Because if you want to be a living donor of your hand to your child, for example, how do you get informed consent? How can you really explain to someone what their life is going to be like without a hand? And how do you convey that, and how do they really understand the gravity of the decision that they're making? So the science is always advancing, which hopefully means the opportunity to save and enhance lives is always advancing. And I know sort of three of the big issues that we're going to be sort of focusing on, because there's a gazillion issues that we can talk about. But first, are you allowed or even required to become an organ donor? The whole notion of compensation, which as I talked about before, is currently against federal law, but there are a lot of movements about to sort of chip away at that, whether it's tax incentives, whether it's allowing compensation for funeral expenses. Does that encourage donation, but does that lead to exploitation? That's kind of the tension with that debate that's been going on for many years. And then the idea of the registry for deceased organ donation. And as much as an advocate as I am, I don't sit in any position to say absolutely everybody should do it. What I do ask is that everybody should talk about whether it's right for them and have that conversation with their family and make that decision known, as I was talking about. But I think it would be wonderful if everybody thinks about the issue and makes the decision that's right for them. So with that, I will turn it over to you, Rabbi.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Wes, like Brad said, there are a gazillion issues. We're going to cover a few of them, and we're going to cover a lot of material today. Let's start from living donors, live donors. The first thing that we need to think about before we delve into the deeper areas of the discussion is we know that there's a problem with electing the problem with damaging oneself. Okay, so let's take a look at source number one. Maimonides is forbidden to injure oneself or another person. This is a very important but perhaps countercultural Torah directive that we don't own our bodies. The Torah concept is we do not have the ownership over our bodies to allow ourselves or subject ourselves to damage our bodies. It's perhaps a countercultural idea. So if this is so, how can we elect to put ourselves under the knife to donate an organ? Let's look at this topic first. So if you look at source number two, we'll see the rationale behind this law that we just saw from the Rambam. It is forbidden to hit another person with the victim's permission, even with the victim's permission, because a person doesn't have ownership on his body to allow himself to be injured. And so the question is, how can I put myself under the knife? And for that, we'll take a look at source number three. Source number three is the full version of the Maimonides. It's forbidden to injure oneself or another person, and then he adds the last words, by the means of a fight. So the contemporary halachic deciders extrapolate from that Rambam, and they understand, or Moshe Feinstein for one, they understand that this prohibition of subjecting oneself to be injured is in a means of a fight, of a controversy, of a battle. But if somebody does it for a purposeful reason, for example, Moshe Feinstein speaks about, and we did this class together, Neil, elective surgery for cosmetic purposes, for psychological reasons, a person would like for the self-esteem, he considers that as a valid reason to put yourself under the knife. So all the more so, and I just wanted to get this out of the way, for sure, when we're talking about potentially saving somebody's life, that I'd be able to subject myself to have surgery done to save somebody's life. So the truth is that we should know the truth is that we know that to save somebody's life is of the highest values in Torah. And although the Torah is full of commandments and mitzvahs, positive mitzvahs, negative mitzvahs, those that we should do, those that we shouldn't do, everything is pushed aside in order to save a life besides the three mitzvahs. And that's source number four. For there's nothing that stands in the way of saving a life other than idolatry, illicit relationships, and murder. So virtually all mitzvahs in the Torah are set aside when it comes to saving somebody's life. So I have this situation in front of me where I need to save somebody's life, and the only way I could do that is by transgressing one of the Torah's commandments. I would transgress it unless it's one of those big three. So there's no question about it that I can allow myself and give permission for myself to be cut in order to save somebody's life. There's no question about that. Okay, so now that we spoke about that, the question is, perhaps there is actually a requirement to agree to be a live organ donor. There's a requirement to do that. Let's look into that. Source number five is the famous verse in Vayikra. It says, Do not stand by your brother's blood. When your brother's blood is being spilled, don't just stand by and not do anything. Be proactive and do something to save him. This is the Torah's commandment for us to get involved to save somebody's life. And the Gemara in source number six, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, learn specific things from this verse. Take a look at source number six. From where do we know that one who sees someone drowning or being dragged by a wild animal or being threatened by robbers is responsible to save him? So if I observe somebody who's being about to lose his life, drowning, being attacked by a wild animal or by thieves, so where do we know that I'm responsible to jump in? We learn it from the verse, do not stand aside when your fellow's blood is being spilled. L'Yisamad al Dam Re'echo requires every one of us to be proactive and not to stand by idly while our brother's blood is being spilled. So the question here right now is, at what expense? Okay? So I can call 911. I can throw out a lifesaver. Right, I can if I know how to shoot a gun while somebody's being attacked by somebody, by a murderer. Right, those are things that I could do without risking my own life or limb. The question we need to delve over here is, at what expense, at what risk of my own life, and at what risk of my own limb would I be required to jump in to save somebody else's life? So, like everything, every contemporary issue, the way the halachic process delves into this is we try to find something which is similar in previous writings, in the classical writings. And so the contemporary halachic deciders, the contemporary poskim, cite a medieval responsa from the Radbaz. Radbaz was Rabbi David ben Zimra. He wrote a collection of responses to halachic inquiries that people made of him at that time. It was in the 1600s. He lived in Tzfat. Am I wrong? No, 1700s, 16th century. 1500s, I'm sorry. Thank you. A lot earlier than we were talking. Right. right, that's at the time of the Shulchan Aruch. Right. So he was posed with some of these dilemmas, and I'm going to share with you just the bottom line. Okay? The whole lengthy, everybody wants a lengthy discussion right here. I'll tell you what it comes out with. So first he discusses the requirement to risk our own life. At what expense? So let's talk about the two extremes. So if I would, in order to save somebody's life, I would have to risk my life, and the assessment is that it's more than likely, that means over 50%, that I would lose my life, I'm not allowed to risk my life to save somebody else's life. Okay? We can talk about wars, we can talk about armies, different discussion. Okay? But outside, what's that?
You also talk about throwing yourself in front of a shooter to save someone else's life.
Right. Right. Shielding somebody else. So I would not be able to. And the thought process behind this is the famous passage from the Gemara that talks about my chodis de domok de dead sumach tfei. How do I know that my blood is redder, quote unquote, than his? This is actually a quote from the opposite situation. If I would be put into a situation where if somebody would hold a gun to my head and say, jump on top of this baby, smother this baby, kill him, or I'll kill you. So the halacha says I must not be active, I must be passive. I can't do that. I can't actively do something to kill somebody else because perhaps his blood is redder than mine. In other words, the value of his soul versus the value of my soul, there's no way for a human being to assess that. I cannot take the assumption that my blood is redder, and I can't take that assumption that my life is more important to God, and therefore to go do something proactive. Now this is the inverse. This is absolutely the opposite of that. I cannot do something active. I can't take an action to put myself, at my life online, in order to save somebody else's life. And the number that the Radbaz puts for that is 50%. If it's more than likely, that we need some good experts to tell us that, but theoretically, you can have somebody tell you this is, you have 50% chance of dying if you donate your limb. If you would do something, if you do something to save somebody else, you would not be allowed to. You would not be allowed to put yourself in that jeopardy to save somebody else because you could not make that decision that your life is less important than that person's. The other extreme is a small risk. I'm going to put myself in a small risk to save somebody else's life. And that is the other extreme that we're required to. We're required to put ourselves in some sort of a risk. Like the examples over here. Somebody's drowning and somebody's being attacked. That involves some sort of a risk. As a matter of fact, people take risks all the time just for their livelihood. Right? And this is another good discussion for a terror of tycoons down the line. People put their lives into somewhat of a jeopardy to make a couple bucks. So to save somebody else's life, we are for sure required, because of the mitzvah, Leisamo Damreyecha, don't stand by your brother's blood, we'd be required to put some element of risk. And I recognize that we still have a gray area between 50% and wherever I'm talking about. Okay, so now, Radvaz goes a little further. He says, and again, exactly which, where in that gray area he's talking about will continue to be a gray area, but listen to the next piece. Under 50%, but more than, you know, significant risk, he calls it, he says it's not prohibited. You're allowed to do it, but he calls it a chassid shaita. He calls it you are a pious fool. It's somewhere in between. It's not that you're prohibited to do it. You haven't transgressed anything, but it's an act of pious foolishness. So it's somewhere in between. Okay? And I can't say exactly the number, and not that we know what's 50% exactly, but we're getting some sort of a scale over here. So we start from the beginning. Yes, we must put ourselves in some risk to save somebody else's life. If we're going to put ourselves into more than likely we're going to die, lose our lives, we are not allowed to. Somewhere in between there is a category of pious foolishness. Okay, now we move on to our topic. Okay, the Radvaz was asked, our topic, because the organ donation that's being done today, I think that our discussion is where there is a very good chance of donor survival. I mean, I think the regulations will not allow that, except if you're in Bangladesh and they grabbed you in a dark alley and didn't take that into effect. But they didn't take that into account. Okay. But the Radvaz was asked a fascinating question. Apparently this was not just a theoretical question, it was an unfortunate, real question. Somebody was posed with the challenge, the need to make a decision between giving up a limb or somebody else's life. The ruler threatened to kill a person. The ruler came to somebody and forced him. He said, either you let me chop off your arm or I will kill another person. What a dilemma. This apparently was a real dilemma. Okay? So what would you do in such a situation, heaven forbid? You chop off your arm, allow me to take off your arm, or I'm going to kill somebody else. So again, if we're talking about a situation where it's 50% or more that the person would die from that amputation, so then that was the discussion we discussed already before. But we're talking about where the person would survive, but have pain and have the loss of a limb, a valuable limb, and live the rest of his life with an amputated arm. So they asked this question to the Radvaz. Boy, I'm glad I don't have to answer these questions. He says as follows, and this is really relevant to our discussion. He says a person is not required to do that. However, if a person could withstand the test, he is praised and he's praiseworthy. So it's right there in between. That the person is not required, but wow, if you could withstand such a test to save somebody else's life by giving up one of your limbs. So come back to our contemporary discussion of live organ donation. So according to most contemporary Paiskim today, where very common discussion is about kidney donation. That is, I think, where it's the most chances of success and the most advanced. Correct?
Mm-hmm. And the most common.
And most common. So this is exactly what the halachic deciders are saying. Mm-hmm. You are not required, but if you can do it, wow. And I have to just say that there are two donors in this room, altruistic organ donors, and I stand in awe of them. if they'd like, if they would, if I can identify them, if they allow that, I will. Otherwise, we'll blame it, save it on. Okay. Right, Chaim Major and Adam Lemfall. We stand in the, and I want to share with you a fascinating statistic over here. The organization that both of you work with, You worked with Renewal?
No. University Hospital.
Okay. Now, the organization that Father Yosef over here worked with is called Renewal. He actually gave me this stuff over here. Fascinating thing over here. I mean, if you take this home, you will cry when you read these pages here. Fascinating statistic. I confirmed this 2 days ago with the director of that organization. This is an organization where Jewish donors are signing up to donate their kidneys for people that they don't know. And for Jewish people from around the world who are on the list who they don't know. And that's called altruistic donation. 20% of this past year's kidney donation, altruistic organ donations of the United States was organized by this little company. 20%. And what's fascinating to me is I think that while I'm in awe of anybody who would do that, even for a close relative, I think what is happening here is the sense of brotherhood that these people are feeling is something that should leave us with great respect for it. The brotherhood, you know, they're donating to Jews that are they have no idea from all walks of life. And so I think that this mitzvah is something that we should as a community we should all encourage. And this a little plug for that organization. And do you want to say something?
I just wanted to say time, but for me, the whole talk about endometriosis goes back to when I was younger, and you weren't, the message that we got was, you can't donate anything because you need everything when we're resurrected. So my question really is, what are we allowed to donate? And to me, that's the educational piece that needs to be given to our community. What you are allowed to donate, that people can come forward and donate. That was my first question when I saw the, you know, decided to go through with it. Which is why I was wondering, am I allowed to do this? You can ask for it, but am I allowed to do this? So that's, I think, the piece that
that's interesting. I did not prepare that discussion, although I did read up on that. Mm-hmm. And my brief answer is that if a person could face his creator after his life and say, I saved somebody's life, that is the greatest merit. And this is what the halacha is telling us, that is not a consideration. If you could save somebody's life, and as far as what organs to donate, I mean, basically this discussion, as technology and science moves forward, will become relevant, perhaps, to now it's talking about partial liver donation.
Right.
And again, that's a different statistic. And when we go back to the Radboz discussion here, that's a different statistic of risk of the.
About
that. It depends on the recipient, actually, because depends on whether it's an adult or a child recipient. So if you're donating a part of your liver to a child, because they can just take a left lateral segment, take a much smaller piece of liver, the risk is actually lower. Not just because of the mass of liver that's removed, but also because of the anatomic nature of what they have to take out in terms of bleeding risk and so on. So it's actually lower risk to donate to a child. It's about between 1 in 400 or 500, and maybe for left lateral segments, it's considerably less than that. I don't know the exact number. Probably 1 in 700 or 800. I don't know the exact numbers, but Yeah, it's still certainly less than the 50%.
Right.
Whereas, you know, 30 years ago, yeah, right. So these decisions are always in flux because...
Right. The other piece of it is that those of us who are willing to donate, I've donated a kidney. I asked about donating part of my liver, and I was told I can't because I've already donated a kidney. So, like, I'm off the, you know, I'm out of the pool.
You did your share.
I did my share.
Yeah, and one other organ that we also should mention about for donation is bone marrow,
right.
Which is obviously exceedingly low risk, is in terms of Jews is much more important that Jews get on those donor lists because the tissue typing for getting a kidney or a liver is much less stringent than for getting bone marrow.
But is bone marrow for the donation going to become obsolete in the sense that you can do your own?
It depends on what the disorder is.
Okay.
So there are certain conditions which you can donate your own stem cells. They can freeze through your stem cells and then donate them back to you after your chemotherapy or whatever. But there are other conditions in which you can't do that. It's certainly not yet obsolete. And there are a number of what's interesting is the registries for bone marrow tend to be ethnically specific. So there's an organization called Gift of Life is one of the big Jewish donor registries, and it's much more likely that you will get a donor if you are in need of a bone marrow transplant, that you'll get a donor from not just a Jew, but a Jew who's got the same ethnic background as you. So, you know, if you're Ashkenazi, the donor more likely needs to be Ashkenazi and so on.
Okay, yeah.
The case of the device, which is that arm cut off, mm-hmm. You know, there's an arm missing and you don't have an arm.
Right.
And all three of these people that had kidneys, right. from looking at them, not from medicine thing, they're the same after. I know they're missing a kidney, obviously,
mm-hmm.
But doesn't that end the discussion at all, the distinction made between...
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to be a lower amount of in the scale of actually disability is going to be right. They don't look disabled at all. But I'm still in great awe. Okay, we have two more sections. So I want to work through it.
That's me. That's the big
problem. Uh huh. Okay, so two more sections over here. Let's try to go quickly. The next one we want to talk about is taking payment from for organ donation. Now. Just put it in a frame of reference here. If it's illegal in the country that you reside in, follow the local laws. But now the discussion that we're going to have is it illegal from a Torah perspective not regarding that, if you live in a different country, or if there's going to be some movement back towards taking payments. So source number 7. This is an interesting concept. We talked about it at a previous Torah Tycoons here as well. What is the Torah source that one may not accept payment for judging or for teaching Torah? Says Rev Yehuda in the name of Rav, the verse says, "See, I have taught you," God tells us, "just as I have taught you Torah at Sinai for free, so too must you teach Torah for free." Okay, this is where we see that mitzvah jobs must be for free. So, by the way, that's why we're driving around, all the Torah teachers are driving around old cars. You probably want to know how we take any money. I'll tell you in a minute. Okay. But source number 8, look at that. "And for all the jobs that are commandments, one may not accept payment." And the rationale for this is that it's a disgrace to the mitzvah that you're doing it for the money rather than doing it for the altruistic reason of doing the mitzvah. So, parenthetically, how is a rabbi or a doctor allowed to take payment? Right? A doctor is also a mitzvah job. Take a look at source number 9. A doctor is not allowed to receive payment for his knowledge or his studies, but is allowed to receive payment for his bother and unemployment. Okay, and that's Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so it's basically the time that the rabbi or the doctor is spending to do the mitzvah and not out there doing the other jobs and making the big bucks, that allowed it. Compensate. I haven't figured out yet why the doctor's compensation for unemployment is more than the rabbi. I'm still working on it. No, seriously, we seriously had some serious discussion on that. And somebody said, yeah, so the rabbi can go out and charge it. Let him do it. Okay.
And that's why you know, the insurance company pays us 30 cents on the dollar.
That's right. The insurance company learned this. Okay, however, the consensus is that on this there's a distinction to make on the type of mitzvahs, and since organ donation is a voluntary thing, and a person is not required to do it by the long stretch, he technically would be able to take compensation for it. Again, it's legally American law prohibits that, and perhaps it's a very good idea. The Pais can talk about this. It's a good idea to structure some laws about it because of the tremendous risks to life that happens when you don't have these laws. But from a strictly halachic point of taking compensation for this mitzvah, it actually would be allowed. And I'd like to move quickly to the final section so we could open the floor for questions and answers. Okay, final section is about deceased donation. Okay, donation from cadaver. Brad told me that one cadaver can save up to 11 lives. That's fascinating. Okay, so let's look at a few of the issues here. So not only does the Torah teach us that there is holiness to a human body while the soul is residing in that body, but the Torah also teaches us that there is a residual holiness that lasts even after the soul departs. There's a holiness to the body that once was a container for a holy soul. And take a look at source number 10. If he orders that he not be buried, we do not listen to him. For burial is a mitzvah, as it says, for you shall bury him. So burial, the proper dealing with the body, is not up to the person who was once in that body. It's the respect that's intrinsically deserving to that body. As a matter of fact, there is a little bit of a conversation about this. Does the donor's opinion while he's alive, does that make a difference, like it does in the donor registry? But halachically, does that make a difference to using his organs to save somebody's life or not? There's a discussion, and I moments before I started this class, I just got off the phone with a leading Pesach in Chicago, and he agreed with my assessment that it would not be up to the person, halachically, would not be up to the person's choice. It would be either it is halachically mandated for that organ to transfer, or it's not. Okay, let's take a look at source number 11. It is forbidden to leave the deceased person overnight unless he's left overnight for the honor, such as to bring a coffin and shrouds. So the honor that we afford to a corpse is one of that we treat with sanctity. And there's a funeral is delayed for a greater funeral procession, but that's the honor of the deceased. And source number 12, a corpse is forbidden to derive benefit therefrom. So you can't take benefit from a corpse. Okay, so now here we're talking about is a dead person just died, had a tragic accident, and his organs are ready to be harvested to save somebody else's life. We have a halacha, and we have a rule from the Talmud and Avodah Zarah that says we can't have benefit. Are we allowed to do it? So we go back to source number 4. Nothing stands, no prohibition stands in the face of saving lives. Okay? So we would transgress this in order to save lives. So, but you will know, you may know that there is not a great push amongst the halachic deciders to go register with the when you sign up your license. and I'm going to tell you why. When you go sign, when you renew your license, there's actually a problem halakhically with signing up, and I delved into this issue. I'm going to tell you what I came up with, what the issues are. The primary issue is that the definition of the moment of death, the definition of death, halakhically is going to be decided under different parameters than what the medical ethics committees will decide in the hospitals. And we're not getting into that we're talking about. That's a whole topic on itself, the definition of death. The medical community is now, and you were telling me that it's trying to be defined in multiple ways, either brain death or even cardiac death, right?
DCD.
DCD is...
Cremation after cardiac death.
Right, there's a discussion about...
Cardiac death.
Right, do you want to explain that for a minute?
So it's basically, and doctor, you're probably better at describing it than I am in terms of brain death versus circulatory or cardiac, mm-hmm. and how that makes you eligible.
As a donor?
Yes.
So brain death is the cessation of all neurological functions in the brain. That means that not just the thinking and consciousness functions. I think there's a common misconception that somebody that there is a some degree of similitude between somebody who is in a deep coma and somebody who's brain dead. They're very, very different things. So in brain death, there's not only no consciousness, there's not only no perception of any pain or stimulus, there's also cessation of all the functions of what's called the brainstem, or the lower part of the brain that controls the autonomic functions of the body. So things like breathing, all of the innate reflexes that are mediated through the central nervous system. So that's what brain death is. It's a very strictly defined criteria. You know that if you were to be brain dead, your heart will still be beating because the heart has automaticity of its own. The heart will beat. You can take the heart and put it into a bath of electrolyte solution and perfuse it, and it will beat on its own without a body. That's the analogous situation in brain death. So all of the autonomic functions of the brain are gone. Cardiac death is cessation of the circulation. The heart stops beating, so there's no longer circulation. In donation after cardiac death, the most common situation of donation after cardiac death are patients who have irreversible disease. The physicians, the patient is on large amounts of life support. The physicians decide that there's no chance of recovery and support is withdrawn. This has a whole host of obvious of halakhic problems. When a donor is when organs are donated from somebody from a donation for a cardiac death situation, the withdrawal of support occurs instead of in the ICU, in the operating room, so they can harvest the organs as soon as the patient, as soon as the circulation stops, so that the organs don't begin to deteriorate.
Okay, so this is a different discussion, and we actually addressed it a number of years ago at a session with Dr. Yigal Kam from the University Hospital, and this is going to pose a lot of halakhic problems. If we sign up and we're basically giving that decision over to the medical ethics teams that decide this, or the committee, the halakhic definition of death is going to be different. And so the question is, well, what about starting our own list that is going to be under the purview of halakha? And so there have been actually a number of attempts to do such a thing, and there is the expert halachic posik that I spoke to on this issue was actually encouraging for this to develop further. I know that David brought along with him some brochures. There is one such organization, is HODS, Halachic Organ Donation, which basically it sets up a legal structure where somebody can sign up to say that my organs can be donated within halachic parameters. And I believe that's still under development. It's an existing organization.
Yeah, you can.
The only thing I want to add to that is there is sometimes a misconception that it's all fluid and there's one person involved. But it's really a very separate process. You have your medical team, if you will, doing everything they can to save your life. And it is not until and unless you are declared either brain dead or dead via circulatory death that the organ donation process and people can even become involved. So we do not enter a room until that patient and unless that patient has been declared dead. So there's always the concern, well, are people really, you know, are the doctors really going to do everything they can to save me, and are the organ donation people hovering outside the room ready to pounce? It is very separate, and we keep our distance in terms of donor alliance very much so until and unless that happens.
And the physicians are not the same, are never the same physician.
Right. So there's no conflict of interest and objectives and those kinds of things.
If you talk about a case of a minor, example, I believe there was a story some years ago of a child who had needed a bone marrow transplant, and they couldn't find the match, and the parent had a child for the express hope of that, and the child was in fact a match. But what kind of consent gets involved when you're talking about a minor, and are there laws in place in terms of, it's a little weird, I guess, parents having a child for the express purpose, at the same time it's a life-saving
If I remember correctly in that case, because that was a really ethically very difficult case. If I remember in that case, obviously parents have both the legal right as well as the halachic right to be the advocate for their children, to give consent for medical treatment. However, if I'm not mistaken, in that case, the courts set up an independent guardian as a second decisor
because of the parents' vested interest,
and because of the the whole idea of having a child as a donor. I mean, that was why they went and had another child.
Wasn't it also tricky because the disease that the first child had, the second child also had?
I don't think it was. I think this was some sort of leukemia, or I think it was the AML or something, if I'm not mistaken.
Neil,
there's no such a limit to international intrigue, also in corruption. And I'm curious on two sides of the issue. Selling the organs, the other is
buying
from abroad and getting yourself ahead of the list in another country, putting yourself ahead of someone else because you have the finances.
There were some prosecutions in Israel. Was it last year or the year before? With organs in Turkey and
there are also transplant programs in the country that will not treat you post transplant if you've gone abroad because they can't verify that it was on the up and up. They frankly don't know what they're walking into medically in terms of the procedure and all those kinds of things. So I think that's probably set up transplant program by transplant program. But, those are very legitimate concerns.
Right now.
Yeah.
Put your money down, and they'll treat you in India, and you'll get first-class care.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, what about putting yourself ahead of other people who can't afford to do that?
Yeah.
Well, and there's the idea of co-listing as well. I mean, people question whether Steve Jobs, for example, somehow gamed the system. Well, it is legal and perfectly okay in terms of how the system works to what's called co-list. So if you say, I'm in Denver and I need a liver, but I happen to know that based on geography and all these other factors of how the system works, that it is a shorter wait time in Memphis, so I have the resources to fly down to Memphis, which is what Steve Jobs did, get accepted by a transplant program there, get listed in both places, and sure enough, he was transplanted much more quickly in Memphis. That is permitted But that also isn't necessarily fair because not everybody has the resources to be able to do that. And that is something that UNOS, the national organization, is really struggling with, how to even neutralize that that issue.
Families who are encountering this dilemma will tell you that, you know, not everybody can afford health care. And those who can't afford it get their leg up. We had this conversation actually in the previous session. You know, it's kind of like the facts of life. You can afford a better health style.
Or you're very comfortable living a very comfortable life, but many other people are not.
Right. There were some passionate conversations around that.
Brad, I did have a question about how do you get to the front of the list? Is it based on when you got on, or is it based on how bad
it's called a MELD score, and it factors in all of those factors. So as you get sicker, if you're on the wait list, you climb more quickly. It's a multitude of factors, but it is the same across the country, and that MELD score changes all the time.
And you can appeal the score. So we have patients who would, if you score them by the strict criteria of the score, the pediatric version is called the Pell score. So if their Pell may only turn out to be 6, but there are other, we can appeal the score to the UNOS board based on medical factors that are not taken into account in the score, and you can get a higher score. And then those appeals have to be renewed every couple of weeks. They only last for a short time. Because the physiologic condition of the patient changes.
The other thing is that those of us who have donated, we get points for that.
And in Israel, there was a law passed, I believe, 1 or 2 years ago, that if you sign up as a donor, if you sign a donor card, that you will get preference should you need a transplant. Because in Israel there's a very low rate of people signing up as potential donors, so it was a way to encourage donation.
That's interesting because I did sign up at the when I renewed my license, and I thought that it was halakhically accepted
if the decision, you know, the decisions have to be made with halakhic input.
The problem is not knowing. I mean, you should live long. But theoretically, a person has had, there are potentially some differences between halakhic and medical ethics, and that should be decided through halakhic. Yeah.
And it's a lot like, almost think of it as an advanced medical directive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an extension of that where, again, it's the kind of document you want to give to your friends and family.
Yeah. Right. You
should sign up
a living will.
You should sign up and start a license if you have a living will or a halakhic directive about your care. You'll probably.
And I can provide that document for
you.
I'll
go back to the DMV and change it. Yeah. Call the computer.
Yeah, take good job.
Nice. Okay. Oh, just one more question for Rick.
No, just to put a face on it, just so we have some donors. So I have a liver disease, so people understand this is a real issue. So I have a liver disease, and 80% of the people with my disease will need a transplant in their lives. So I have a null score. My score is very low, but at some point, I may be calling him again.
I asked him, and we're so
different
in
size, but I did ask.
Depends on what you drink.
Yeah. I think it's a dynamic group that we have here, both physicians, activists, donors, and potential recipients.
I'm actually on call to give my lip kidney to my father.
Really?
If he ever needs to play, thank God he is not.
You're a match?
I'm the only match in the whole town. I don't know how that worked out.
Genetics.
Genetics by marriage.
Thank you, everybody.